Case is the Stanley case versus the Bristol Department of Social Services, which is another consolidated case. Okay, counsel. This is a consolidated case. How long do you believe that you need, given that these are usually 15 minutes, it's consolidated? You tell me what you need. You don't
15
have your...
minutes would be fine for me.
Okay, Mr. Sutherland is not present. Is that correct? Okay, very good. I noted in the file that he indicated he would not be there. It's the garden ad litem. Counsel, how long do each of you think that you will need?
I probably, for Mr. Stanley, need 10 minutes, if that.
Somewhere around 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, I don't want to limit you. I'm just trying to see how we need to combine, because both of you have. So if you each need, you think, 10 minutes, that means 20 minutes. That means that clearly I'll give you 20 minutes if you need it, sir. But be mindful that we've read the file. Just as in all of our cases, we've read the file, not just the file, we've read and gone through the transcripts and are very familiar with your case. So, what?
Which
yeah. Yeah, who wants to step up first? He wants to step into the box.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to reserve, I guess, 2 minutes of my 10 minutes.
And sir, you are?
Robert Black. I represent Jacqueline Stanley and her in this matter. Your Honor, I know, just as you said, that the court's very aware of the record and the transcript, but for purposes of today, I'd just like to kind of review briefly some of the high points of the evidence that was submitted, because our assignments of error are threefold. The first being that the circuit court erred by finding, by clear and convincing evidence, that Ms. Stanley had not remedied substantially the conditions that led to removal. And I think the key word here is substantial, Your Honors. The statute doesn't require her to have remedied every single thing that the department had concerns with, just that she substantially did so. And so to determine that, we really kind of got to look back at the beginning of the case. And again, I know the court's read through the transcript. There's a very detailed list of facts, I think, in the foster care plans about how the child came into care, kind of where her mental health status was at the time.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt you, because it seems to me, you know, these are difficult cases in any event, but they're particularly difficult when you're dealing with parents with mental illness or mental disorders of one sort or another. And it seems to me with your client, what this really boils down to, and you correct me if you disagree, but what really boils down to is the trial court made certain factual findings regarding the inability of your client to remedy her situation. With those with mental disorders of one sort or another, it crops up not only in this kind of an arena, but in the criminal arena as well, where modern pharmacology is a wonderful thing, and many times individuals with mental illnesses of one sort or another, if they take their medication, they're fine, and they can function quite adequately in society, but they don't, because of side effects or the way it makes them feel or whatever. It seems to me that's sort of what we have here. The trial court made some factual findings, which, of course, we're bound by if there's evidence in the record to support them, and there clearly is, based on the expert testimony and some of the other matters that were testified to, that she has issues that are controllable through medication, but she doesn't take the medication consistently, and therefore is not, in effect, remedying the situation that caused the emergency removal of the children in the first instance. So do you want to address that?
Your Honor, respectfully, I would submit to the court, I disagree that there was evidence sufficient to make that finding in this case. There wasn't a single medical record introduced. I think the court is going by a lot of lay testimony about some things that they observed the mother do. The only expert testimony was a report by Dr. Wayne Lanthorne, who basically said, and that was the psychological evaluation that she did for DSS. And in his evaluation, he didn't find anything really preventing her from taking care of these kids. And I think I quoted in my brief exactly what he says there. But I mean, that's really the only expert testimony we have.
Let me pin you down and see which of the factual findings you assert are not supported by the record. it seems to me the trial court, first of all, found that these children basically had special needs. You're not disputing that, are you?
Yes, Your Honor. I would respectfully dispute that the children have special needs. And really the only special needs, and again,
well, the court specifically identified Jay-Z as having severe...
Right.
Or more pronounced, I guess, special needs.
Right. The court uses the word special needs, but it doesn't elaborate on what these special needs were. So you got to look at the record to see what are these special needs. And really the only thing that is listed is some behavioral problems and ADHD. Those are the special needs of this child. If I had a child with ADHD, I wouldn't consider him a special needs child necessarily. I mean, that with medication, a lot of those children, their needs are taken care of. I think of special needs as someone who requires a constant care for the rest of their life. Someone who's maybe a low IQ or something like that. But I don't think, respectfully, I disagree that the evidence supported that these children were special needs. And really the only evidence, as the court mentioned, of any kind of special needs is with Jay-Z, not a P.S. She really didn't have anything, and therefore I don't think there clearly was not evidence support.
Well, the court also found that the mother had a significant mental health impairment requiring, quote, stable and constant medication. Whether the evidence supports that or not?
Well, Your Honor, I think there was some evidence supporting that she needed medication, clearly, but I think she had remedied that. And if you look at Ms. Comer's testimony, I think it was, she came off of her medication, and everybody in DSS was aware of it, and everybody thought, well, she's doing fine. She's doing great. And she came off of it, as she testified, because she was pregnant and she was worried about birth defects of her unborn child, which I think is a very reasonable reason to come off of your medication temporarily. And so, again, the DSS was aware of that and doing fine, and they were aware of it at the time in early June, claimed she was doing so well that they were ready to place the children back in her care. So she had, again, you look at the foster care plan, there's six of them done, five of them affirmed by the court, four of them, the first four, all said substantial progress. Barriers, the only barrier they listed was stability for 4 to 5 months. Then stability for 4 to 5 months, then stability for 4 to 5 months. And her behavior, the only other barrier listed was her ability to manage Jay-Z's behavior. Not one barrier listed in any of those foster care plans involved mental health. Not one.
But counsel, maybe,
until the very last.
Excuse me, but maybe I misread it, but I thought that after the child was born, she had a psychotic episode. Did she not?
There was some evidence that I think Ms. Gregg testified that she saw her speaking to someone once when she was around her. But I think the vast majority of the evidence was she had some paranoia, a little bit of paranoia, and depression. Postpartum depression, I think it was. And so that was from basically June until October. And in October, the department created another plan that said basically we don't feel it's in the child's best interest to terminate rights at this point. That was in August. And then something happened, which I addressed in my brief. I'm not really sure exactly what happened, but they, at the date of court, in Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, they decided, no, we don't want to proceed with this plan, asked the court not to approve it, and then came back with the final plan, which was the termination of parental rights. So, I mean, I think as far as the mother's mental health as well, you look at the department didn't provide any evidence really after October. In this case, that was October of 15, so this case was heard in March of 16, and all the evidence after that was she was doing much better. They didn't really have any concerns, and I mean, she was basically in the same position she was back in June of 2015, which is really what, if you look at the August foster care plan before they withdrew it, which is what they asked her to do, kind of get in the position she was in back in June of 2015.
Had the children been in foster care for a year? So that was October 15th date, did you say?
I think they went in January of 14, if I'm not mistaken. And so by October of 15, they were in almost a year and a half.
So by that time, the parents had run out of their 1 year, their mother run out of the 1 year time period in which to correct the problems.
I think as I stated in my brief, this court has previously held that the trial court can look at evidence.
It can, but does it have to? You argued no evidence was presented as to the mother's condition after October 2015.
Well, I think towards the best interest of the child, the court has to look at the present best interest, not just what happened back then. But if you're going to stick to the 12 months that is
the 12 months only applies to a parent's the time period in which a parent has to correct the problems that led to the initial assumption of custody.
I think if you look at that 12 months, she clearly did. I mean, the only reason that they didn't move towards reunifying at the end of that initial 12 months was because of one positive screen for marijuana. That was it. And that wasn't she did everything DSS asked of her. After she tested positive once, she went and did the drug classes, completed those classes, and it was never an issue ever again. And that at the end of that 12 months, that's really the only that happened, I think, like right around the time of a new foster care plan being put in place. So she was, you know, I think they mentioned something about some, you know, her maybe not having stable housing, but even in the foster care plan, it said, well, this wasn't her fault. She had housing at that time towards the end of that 1 year period. So I think she had substantially remedied it. I mean, any definition of the word, she had substantially remedied at the end of that 12 months, and as well as at the end of at the time of the case. And I think, Your Honor, one point I would like to make, and I know my time's getting ready to run out, is that at the time of the hearing, she had that new child. And they never removed the child. She had the child in her care for 9 months. DSS was involved. The parental sensei was involved. If she hadn't substantially remedied those conditions, her mental health condition, I just don't see how the two can coexist. They don't remove the newest child, the infant baby who can't even take care of herself. I mean, the youngest, most susceptible to abuse or neglect, they don't remove, and admittedly hadn't removed for 9 months. How can those two coexist? I would submit to the court that they just can't. And for that reason, you know, I would argue that the trial court erred. And then, you know, finally, my last assignment of error, it deals with the trial court's, you know, the failure to or the consider the grandparent. And I think, you know, I quoted Sauer versus Franklin County DSS, which, you know, basically states that the agency seeking termination has an affirmative duty to investigate all reasonable options for placement with the immediate relatives, and that relatives have no duty to present themselves. And in this case, the grandmother had filed a petition in Juvenile Domestic Relations Court. She withdrew that petition. But if you read the transcript, I made that argument in both motions to strike, and the court at the end during my closing said that Ms. Jackson, which is my client's mother, wasn't appropriate because she withdrew her petition in Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, and that and the court also found that DSS didn't investigate her because she withdrew that petition. So I think it's clear that the court, because of the grandmother not coming forward, didn't, even though I did present some evidence through the grandmother, he didn't consider that evidence because he felt that DSS didn't investigate it and didn't have to because she didn't present herself, which I think is clearly in contradiction to the or contradictory to the Sauer opinion. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Justices. David Eddy from Bristol, Virginia, and I represent Jason Stanley. And I have the harder job between the two of us. Mr. Black has the mother, and I have the dad. And as you know, Mr. Stanley was a visiting parent. He was the one who didn't live with the mother when the child was removed. And he wasn't even living in Virginia during.
He essentially abandoned the family.
Well, I would call it being the visiting parent, being somebody who was.
Put it this way: for a year, he had no contact with her.
Between, you're right, Judge. Between January of 2014 and September of 2014, he did visit in that time period, and this was during the time that the child was in foster care. He had regular, twice monthly, I believe, visits with both children. And remember, he was visiting all the way from Kentucky, so he was traveling 5 or 6 hours to see these children. it became a financial hardship that he couldn't overcome. And just as importantly, he believed two things. One, that the mother was making great progress. And if you look at the foster care reviews and the fact that they kept continuing them, and as Mr. Black pointed out in his brief, when the goal is a return home and you reset it for a foster care review hearing, you're basically conceding that the mother is making substantial progress. So Mr. Stanley, throughout the pendency of the children being in foster care, was believing that the mom was making substantial progress, complying with all the services that DSS provided, doing all the right things, housing, medication.
I'm not sure it helps necessarily your client.
Okay, so getting back to your question about, well, what about the fact that he didn't visit for
since agree. I mean, I think anybody would logically agree it's never going to be in a child's best interest to have an absentee parent who it's, you know, either drops off the face of the earth completely or to the point where they're showing up once in a blue moon.
Agree with that. But this is an interesting case in that I think that Mr. Stanley's simply being a visiting parent shouldn't necessarily lead to the conclusion that his right should be terminated. Because as we know, parents have a fundamental right to have custody of their kids, to raise their kids, to visit with their kids. The state only has an interest in terminating those rights if they can overcome some very high barriers or high standards. And I guess what we're here arguing, what I'm here arguing for Mr. Stanley, is that if the natural mother is doing everything she needs to do, complying with services, housing, medication, making progress for all of these months, and if Mr. Stanley believes that to be true, and just like in the Thatch versus and Mendoza case versus Arlington County, where that father there was similarly situated to Mr. Stanley, he came late to the dance, you know, after the goal changed to adoption, and Mr. Mendoza stood up and said, okay, well, gosh, if you're all going to want adoption, then I will do what I need to do as a dad to step up. In this case, in October of 2015, when the goal changed to adoption, Mr. Stanley, at that time, hadn't been visiting, but when they changed the goal so suddenly, he couldn't visit because when DSS changes the goal to adoption, they don't allow either parent to visit. They say, well, you know, if our goal has changed, then you're out of it. And so we're not going to provide services. We're not going to allow any visitation. So at that point, Mr. Stanley is here thinking, well, my wife, the mother of these kids, has been doing so well, and then I'm surprised by Bristol DSS's decision to change the goal, and then now I can't visit. Now I can't get any services. So he has the ultimate Kafkaesque situation where he can't prove that he can be
Counsel,
a custodial parent.
What did it do to assist if he was relying on the mother's the children being returned to the mother, what was he doing to assist the mother as the father of the children? What things did he do to assist her to be able to be rehabilitated? Was he paying support? Was he helping her, you know, with some type of respite care, those kind of things? What was he doing?
Well, the answer to both those questions is no, he wasn't paying support. And they were estranged. She lived in Bristol, had a new boyfriend, was living with him, drawing disability, and he himself was sort of financially not in a necessarily a self-supporting situation himself, so he couldn't help Ms. Stanley to the extent that he probably wanted to.
Well, I'm not suggesting, I mean, that's yet another issue, is whether he's helping his wife or not, but obviously helping her would have been helping the children mm-hmm. on certain issues. That's what I'm trying to get to. What was he doing?
Yeah.
For their best interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I have to concede that he was not doing what a custodial parent should be doing to provide for the kids. And that's, you know, that there's no question about that. He at that time could not have been a proper custodial parent if he's not visiting, if he's not even self-supporting. You know, he can't be a choice for placement. But now another assignment of error, just along with Mr. Black's assignment, is grandparents. We have actually two sets of grandparents that both, during the trial in the circuit court, said, we'd love to have custody of these kids. Ms. Townsend is Jason's mom. She testified at the trial and said, you know, she lives in Kentucky. She has acres and acres of a horse farm. Like with Ms. Jackson, she had a prior pending custody petition. But living in Kentucky, as you said in the prior case, that requires the ICPC, or the ICPC requires a foreign parent to become a foster parent and to go through all of those requirements and a lengthy process. She actually began that process and didn't complete it, and so she wasn't a option for placement by the court at that time. But if somebody is at the trial court in the circuit court and says, I'm the grandmother, paternal grandmother, I want custody, you know, doesn't the court not therefore have a duty, even if she doesn't have a petition that's pending, either in juvenile or circuit court, doesn't the circuit court have a duty to consider that grandparent as a option? Now, in this case, not just with the grandparents, but I think with Jason Stanley, DSS took a very passive role. They felt like, since he lived in Kentucky, he should be the one to get a home study there. You know, and he needs to be the one to do all of the efforts that it takes to convince us that he should have custody. Well, they never reached out or embraced Jason. They never reached out to communicate with him. And Jason's testimony at the trial court was, you know, I called the DSS foster care worker several times to try to reinitiate visitation, et cetera, and she didn't call me back. And I left voicemails, and she didn't call me back. And so he felt frustrated by the lack of communication from DSS. He felt the mother was doing great, and that DSS had focused on the natural mother. They were banking on her to step up to the plate and finally to be the kids be reunited with her. So they were understandably focused on her and kind of ignoring Jason. And, you know, that's understandable too, because she was doing well. And so we were all surprised when they changed the goal. And I would just join in Mr. Black's argument that Ms. Stanley seemed, to my mind, to, and I was involved in this from the very beginning, but she seemed to comply with everything that DSS expected of her. Now, there were some bumps in the road. There's some disagreement she had with her boyfriend. There was a little housing instability briefly. There was a positive marijuana screen. Those are not reasons to terminate a mother's parental rights or a father's parental rights.
Okay, you represent the father, so your argument is that DSS did not show through clear and convincing evidence, which is the standard, that his rights should be terminated. Is that essentially your argument?
Correct, yeah. And also that, you know, if you look at this Thatch versus Arlington County case, I think that the court has to consider each parent, and the court should consider them independently. And if there's a point in time where the mother becomes the person that the DSS doesn't feel is appropriate custodial parent, then they should go and focus their attention and efforts and services on the dad, instead of just saying, well, he, you know, in all these months, he hasn't been doing what he should be doing, so we're just going to ignore him and move forward with termination. And I feel like that's not fair to the dad, that the dad should have an opportunity, just like Mr. Mendoza did in Arlington County, to, you know, when the light bulb goes off, he should have an opportunity to say, okay, well, if you don't think the mom is going to be a proper custodian, well, I can be one. Let me prove it to you. And they just didn't allow that to happen. So thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stout.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It pleases the court. I'm Ed Stout, practice in Bristol. I represent Bristol DSS. I know the court has read the briefs, and I won't go over what I've said there. But I would point out that at the time Piper was born, in July of 2012, Piper was born substance abused. And the department put services in place at that time. So this is a long, ongoing process. And during these time it had services in place, Miss Stanley's behavior deteriorated to the point that she was seeing things, talking to God, thinking her mother had kidnapped a woman that she'd put in the house, and all those things outlined in the brief. And as a result, on December 11 of 2013, 804 days ago, the department took custody of these children because they were not in a safe home. And that remains the case today. Now, the department, the evidence before you is the department really wanted Jackie Stanley to be able to pull this off. And she made progress, progress that we never thought she would make. But then she would backslide with a drug screen, or being put out of her house, or being in the house with an alcoholic or an abuser. The downhill slide with her mental health again, where Breanne Gregg testified that she was in a room talking to somebody who wasn't there. She admitted that the person she was living in was an alcoholic and an abuser. And later she admitted that she couldn't care for these kids. And based on that, the department took the steps of changing the goal to adoption. The juvenile court agreed, and so did the circuit court. I would like to talk just a minute about the grandparents in this case. We have two that came forward. The father's mother in Kentucky filed a petition. It was denied by ICPC. The court couldn't place with her. It was the grandmother, Miss Jackson, the mother's mother, filed a custody petition. She withdrew it. She knew that it was a possibility that she could file again. She testified to that in court at Appendix 289, and she didn't do so. The department also, in this case, sent out letters to relatives asking anybody to come forward. No one did. The department did all it was required to do under the statute, and I would ask the court to so find. As to Ms. Stanley, she was simply unable to correct the conditions that led to the removal. As to Mr. Stanley, he has not seen these children since September of 2014. Under Virginia Code 16.1283C1, he's abandoned these children. He has no plan for their future. Ms. Stanley has, her rights should be terminated under that same section, under C2, because she's failed to remedy the conditions that led to the removal. We would ask the court to so find. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley.
Thank you.
Mr. Black.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to briefly touch on my second assignment of error, which really is part of the first, because, of course, the court has to find first that the termination is in the child's or the children's best interest in this case. And I quoted the factors that the trial court was to consider. And I respectfully think that the heavy weight in this case leads in favor of my client. You know, you look at the age, physical, mental condition of the children. I know the court had an issue with the special needs. I already addressed that. I didn't believe there was evidence to support that. And the mother's mental health, you know, the court didn't make a finding. There wasn't any specific request by the department that I can remember of which code section or which subsection to fall under. 16.1-283B seems more of the, you know, general case where the mother, her mental health is to the extent that she just can't take care of these children, and it's not likely that she will be able to in the future. That the court didn't make a finding, and I think that's significant to point out here. He didn't make that finding, and maybe it was because there wasn't any credible doctor's records or records from therapists introduced at trial. So without that, I think, and the fact that the testimony, again, was that she was doing well at the time of the hearing, I think I would argue that that falls in her favor. The one thing I think that I wanted to make sure I point out before I left here today as well, and I know the court has read Ms. Comer's notes dealing with the relationship between mother and child as the best interest. You read those notes, I mean, it really just pulls at your heart. I mean, it paints a perfect picture, and she was the best, clearest witness, had the most contact with not just, you know, Jerick Finney had contact with Jay-Z and some with Jay-Z and my client, but she didn't, and she worked with an ADHD child in a small office and based her opinion on those interactions. But they also had an expert witness testify, which was Mrs. Comer, who had years of experience working with social services. And her reflection of Ms. Stanley was outstanding. I mean, and she met with not just Jay-Z, which I think was her official client, but P.S.,
let me interrupt you. Hypothetically, if the trial court assigned more weight to Ms. Jerick's testimony than to Ms. Comer's testimony, we can't disturb that, can we?
Well, I think...
I mean, we don't reweigh the evidence and say, well, the court should have given more weight to another witness than they did.
I think this court has the ability to look at the case as a whole and say, was there sufficient evidence? Maybe he placed some weight on Ms. Finney's testimony, but
I don't think there's any question the court placed a lot of weight on that testimony, and it was probably, you know, more or less dispositive in the case of the mother here.
Which I would argue just is plainly wrong in this case. I mean, I don't think any reasonable trier of fact would have placed that much weight on her testimony when you've got this other expert who And that's just with Jay-Z. That Jerick Finney couldn't really testify to anything about P.S.'s best interest. So he didn't mention the distinction there. The court didn't mention the distinction. I think there's clearly a distinction here. The only one that really dealt with everybody together was Ms. Comer. And you know, with respect to the attachment or the relationship between mother and child, Ms. Comer's really the only one that testified to that, and it's clear that there was a very significant relationship or attachment between these children and their mother, and to the extent that the very last visitation she had with them, the kids were screaming, I think, or crying and didn't want to leave the mother, and someone had to basically pick them up and take them away. So you know, for that reason, as well as it's clear that the role the parent played, the mother is the one that raised these children, and the needs of the children. I don't think, you know, the court mentions stability or permanency, but I mean every kid needs permanency. I don't think that really weighs in favor of either side. And to address the you know, what the department has said about Ms. Stanley's admissions that, you know, during, I think, that June period, but maybe she wasn't able to take care of the child at that time. One breath they're saying, well, she wasn't stable, or we can't trust her during that period of time, but we're going to take everything she said as true and as factual. And I don't see how you can do both. I think it's clear that we didn't argue. We admitted in trial that she did have some issues after the birth, but it clearly wasn't to the extent as Mr. Eddy pointed out, or not Mr. Eddy, but the department pointed out, Mr. Stout, that you know, their allegations in the beginning of this were pretty severe, and at the end, not anywhere close, which I think is the definition of substantial remedy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blatter. It's ready.
I have just 1 minute.
Judge Petty asked about the 1 year deadline, the 1 year, you know, where you ring the buzzer and the game is over. And I just wanted this court to understand our position on that. I'm sure it's Mr. Black's position, is that 1 year deadline that's within that statute 283 is a
winner. Right. That's not applicable to the husband, is it, to the father? Your father's rights were terminated because he failed to maintain contact with the child, not mm-hmm. because he was unable to remedy the problems. Yes.
Okay. you know, yes, Mr. Stanley does have that problem. And so, yes, that, in other words, that's an alternative basis to terminate his rights.
And I think that was the only basis
that the court found. Well, if that basis is wrong, and the court would rely on this another basis,
we can't do that. If the court can terminate based on failure to remedy. We can't substitute our judgment
in
the courts.
Then I'll sit down. I won't say any more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Eddy. We will come down and greet counsel. Thank you.